Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I don't recall signing it. Now, the fact that I say I don't recall signing it doesn't mean that I didn't sign it, but I simply don't recall if I signed it.
You got that right. Herman Cain from the other day, not recalling signing but not denying that he would have signed settlements with respect to the sexual harassment claims. And as you know, the Cain campaign is being threatened by these revelations of two sexual harassment case settlements that he made in the 1990s when he was president of the National Restaurant Association. The Associated Press is also reporting on a third woman now who had come forward with an allegation. And after first blaming liberals and the media for this all being made public, Cain is now accusing Rick Perry of orchestrating a smear campaign. The Perry campaign says maybe it was Mitt Romney. Tag, you're it. Romney says, not true. No one yet is targeting Ron Paul, as far as I know. The next televised debates, by the way, are scheduled for Saturday and Monday. They could turn into must-see TV, though not illuminating on the issues, if you like this kind of thing. By the way, Saturday's event on C-SPAN is one-on-one and has a title of the Newt Gingrich, Herman Cain, Lincoln Douglas debate. So if you don't already have plans with your date, you might find out how compatible you really are by suggesting that you just order in and watch the Gingrich, Cain, Lincoln Douglas. Or maybe if you were trying to get someone to break up with you so you don't have to break up with them, suggest it as your idea of a good time. Saturday night at 8 on C-SPAN. But as that blame game of who brought this into the public eye continues, we want to focus on an issue raised by the spectacle right now. Why do accusers in sexual harassment cases sign confidentiality agreements anyway, what some of the media are calling gag orders? The two women who got settlements from the Restaurant Association both agreed to these. There is a media drumbeat now for Cain or the Restaurant Association to release the women from those agreements so they can speak to the public about a presidential candidate. The lawyer for one of the women announced yesterday that she does not want to go fully public, maybe just make a statement that shows her version of events differs from Mr. Cain's if the restaurant group allows it. But what's that all about? Why would she need permission to speak about her own lawsuit? And how common is it to agree to such a thing? We will try to find out now from Rick Rosane, CUNY Law School professor. He teaches what they call the equality concentration and courses on workplace discrimination. Professor Rosane, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you have ever signed a confidentiality agreement in a sexual harassment suit, we want to hear your story, whatever you would be free to say without breaking the agreement. I don't know if there's anybody listening in that particular situation right at the moment, but if you are, 212-433-WNYC. Why did you sign a confidentiality agreement if you brought a sex harassment case against somebody, or if you were a lawyer involved in that? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or for that matter, if you were the employer and you were party to that confidentiality agreement as a suit was settled, let's hear from you. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Why did you want it? Do you regret having it? Cain may regret it now. Was it a good thing? 212-433-WNYC or post to our website at WNYC.org. Professor Rosane, why would these women have signed confidentiality agreements as they accepted cash settlements from Herman Cain's group?
Well, more often than not, it is the employer who really wants the confidentiality agreement as part of the bargain. These are separation and so-called waiver agreements, and what that basically means is a woman files a complaint of sexual harassment. In this case, it sounds like it did not even get to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, but it was just an internal complaint, and the employer responds. And from the employer's perspective, they have a number of different goals. There are two main audiences that they're concerned about. First is they don't want any publicity. They don't want the public to know about it. They want to, in this case, probably protect a high level of person, a manager or a head of a company or an organization. They're concerned about their reputation. The other audience that they're concerned about is their own employees. They want to discourage other complaints. They don't want the employees to know what the terms of the actual condition, how much money was exchanged. And although most employees actually know that there was a complaint, from, I guess, the employees' perspective, some employees want the privacy. They don't want to be out there in the public, and certainly in this situation, like the Anita Hill-Thomas hearings situation. And they may want to keep the information from prospective employees, employers, where they might think, okay, I'm applying for another job, I'm leaving this organization, but I'm concerned that someone finds out that I filed a complaint, they might not hire me.
So it might be to the benefit of both parties. How common is it in sexual harassment settlements? Would you say it happens 50% of the time, 80% of the time?
I would say probably 90 to 98% of the time.
Really?
As I say, mostly employers will not. That's one of their key demands. You must agree not to tell anybody possible. Yeah, obviously, you could talk to your lawyer, maybe your accountant. Sometimes you're even prohibited from talking to a spouse or significant other.
Wow.
About the terms. And certainly nobody in the public or other employees.
I thought the spousal exemption is universal.
Right.
But maybe that's just in our private affairs. The statement from this woman's lawyer mentions that she wants to release a statement through him to show that her version of events is different from Kane's. But she doesn't want to go publicly into what they call minute details of her charge because she, quote, has a life to live and a career and doesn't want to become another Anita Hill. Now, that's a fine and tricky line, isn't it? Trying to show your basic side of a sexual harassment case but not go into detail?
Yes. The facts matter, the story matters, and on the other hand, I absolutely understand her concern. I just attended a couple weeks ago the 20th anniversary of the Hill-Thomas hearings at Hunter College, where Professor Hill talked, and right. We look at her life and how miserable it was for a number of years. She's recovered terrifically, but yes, there are kind of countervailing issues here.
I could see her statement leaving unanswered questions that Kane might respond to, and certainly the press will want answered. Then what?
Yes, I mean, there was a complaint that was made. She felt that there was a factual basis, and the attorney at the time felt there was a factual basis, but it also comes down to credibility issues. Without the full airing of the complaints, it would be certainly unfair to Mr. Kane if only part of the story comes out.
If you were her lawyer, how much do you think you would advise her to stay out of the spotlight?
I would probably advise her to stay out of it completely because your entire life can be in the media and all kinds of charges. And I think it's likely that her identity will become known because other employees who were there at the time, I'm sure, know who it is. And so at some point, her name will probably come out.
So is Herman Cain bound by the confidentiality agreement or only the women?
No. These generally are mutual provisions, confidentiality provisions. Both sides agree not to make anything public. And as I say, more often than not, it's the employer asking for it. But yes, both sides are bound by it.
So does he have to ask the Restaurant Association, which no longer employs him, for permission to speak about the details, as well as the woman has to ask to be released from the confidentiality agreement?
Well, it depends on the terms of the agreement. And the agreement is really essentially a contract. And so whatever the contract says with respect to that, whether he signed it or not, as you know, he's not sure whether he had signed it or not. Likely he did sign it, but it may also and probably signed by his employer. So they may both have legal interests here, and so it depends on the terms of the agreement.
We're talking about confidentiality agreements in sexual harassment case settlements, as is, of course, relevant to the Herman Cain story this week, with Rick Rosane, CUNY Law School professor of workplace discrimination. And we're inviting your stories of signing confidentiality agreements if you were in, on any side of a sexual harassment settlement, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Sam in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC. I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, hi, Brian. It's a very interesting story. I had an 85-year-old boss, and the whole thing started with, me being from an Asian culture. The guy was arthritic, so he was walking in pain. I said, I can rub some tiger balm, an Asian ointment. And he liked it. But then he started making advances towards me and, grabbing me at the wrong places. So finally it ended up in the court. And it so happened that I was subjected to a day and a half time of deposition simply to, intimidate me. The judge was actually colluding with those guys. So then the deposition happened and everything was on the record. But at the same time, the lawyer said this whole agreement has to be sealed. So the judge said the only thing that can be sealed is how much you're paying him, but not the deposition because that's a public record.
Mm-hmm.
So in an actual lawsuit, which I guess McCain didn't go through, it's a different version of confidentiality whereby everything that you say under oath is disclosed to anybody who wants to see it.
That's really interesting. So you signed the confidentiality agreement, at least with respect to the price of the settlement, correct?
Right. And the judge said he cannot, since this is a public court, those are the issues that you said under oath.
Yes.
He can't see it. Whatever has transpired in the court cannot be...
That's really interesting. Sam, thank you very much. And Professor Rosane, is that accurate as far as you know? Once you move into the legal realm, to the point where there are depositions taken, which are under oath, even though they're not in a public courtroom, that those records cannot be sealed in a confidentiality agreement?
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends on which court. That might have been the state of New Jersey court, the different rules on that. Once the deposition is actually filed with the court, it does become a public record. And so it depends on where in the litigation the settlement has occurred. Settlements occur often during a litigation. But many times before depositions are taken. So it really depends on what's happening at the moment and the particular rules of the court.
Do you know how much Cain's accusers were paid and what it would cost them if they went public and violated the gag order?
Well, I only know from the media. There's a report that one woman received a year's salary, which apparently was $35,000. So that's a significant damage settlement, a whole year's pay. And many times, in all these agreements, there is a provision which says that if you violate the provision, you make it public, that you will lose a certain amount of what you were paid. In some cases, the full amount. Some courts have said, no, that is too much. So it depends, once again, on the jurisdiction. But anybody who violates that can lose money. Now, from the employer's perspective, we call it liquidated damages. And they may, if they reveal, okay, this woman, yes, she made a sexual harassment complaint, but let me tell you, she was a lousy employee. And so they're revealing information they should not have revealed. Often there is this liquidated damage provision, which will state the dollar amount that the employer must pay if it can be proven that the employer actually revealed it.
Kevin in Brooklyn. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling. You are a sexual harassment mediator.
Actually, I was a Title VII mediator in the New York District Office of the EEOC.
Uh-huh. And what did that mean you did with respect to this?
I mediated cases under Title VII, and sexual harassment is, one of those statutes in the Title VII.
So did you see this question of confidentiality come up a lot?
All the time. In fact, before the mediation begins, you need to sign the confidentiality agreement with both sides, and I think it's helpful because in most of these cases, maybe it's a woman, maybe she works at a hotel, and she makes maybe $20,000 a year. She doesn't make a lot of money, you know, something happens and, you know, she files a claim. And, you know, once it's settled, she really wants the confidentiality. She can move on, you know, because who wants to go from, you know, job to job and, you know, the world knows that, you know, you sued the last person you worked for. So I think the confidentiality really works for both sides, particularly for a lot of the, you know, most of these cases, they settle in the neighborhood of $2,500. You know, you may read the huge cases, million-dollar cases, but the regular cases that come through the office, and thousands of cases come through there. And, you know, the sexual harassment cases usually settle at around $2,500. People want to move on with their lives. They don't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah. So, Kevin, and, from where you sit with this experience that you have, do you see this Herman Cain story in any particular light that you think we in the news media may not already be discussing?
Oh, absolutely. I've been pounding my Facebook page for the last couple of days. You see, for me, it's my hope that in the Herman Cain matter that the information doesn't come out, because I really don't see where that plays into the whole politics. I think it's just people's, you know, curiosity about knowing who these people are. I don't, you know, I mean, you're going to judge Cain by, you know, his policies overall. I mean, whether or not he has a sexual harassment case, I don't know if it swings one way or another. I mean,
well,
the last couple of days, look how much money he's raised from people who support him. So it's just my hope that we don't trample on issues like confidentiality, because it's kind of where I live. It's like taking due process from a lawyer or probable cause from a cop, you know?
But, Kevin, with what you've seen, and I guess as a mediator, you've seen real cases of sexual harassment brought before you.
Absolutely.
If it's real, then doesn't it inform the public about Herman Cain's character in a way that matters when we're deciding who to elect president of the United States?
Absolutely. But let me just touch on one aspect of what you just said. In terms of, when you look at things like confidentiality, it's kind of, you know, where the rubber meets the road for people who do this kind of work. You know, if you start, you know, breaking the rules like that, you know, it just makes it difficult for the people who do this work day to day.
In terms of
Herman Cain, I mean, why would you just want to throw the baby out with the bathwater with all the rules and regulations around the work we do, just because it's Herman Cain, you know, and we're just curious about, you know,
whether he did it.
These women
Kevin,
are.
I'm going to leave it there. I really appreciate your call. Now,
Brian,
Professor Rosane.
I have a little bit of a response to what Kevin said.
Good.
I disagree in part. I also, by the way, had done some mediation for the U.S. EEOC. And what you find is when you have pro se people who are not represented by attorneys, and often these are low-wage employees, they often accept a much lower damage settlements. And sometimes I think that's part of a problem at the EEOC's mediation, which I think they do a very good job in part. When somebody is represented, the settlement awards are significantly higher, and that there are many settlements that are not before the EEOC. And so I think the figures were somewhat misleading. I also believe, you know, that in terms of whether Mr. Cain sexually harassed somebody, and that's really an abuse of power. It's not just about sexual desire. I think it's a real issue for a presidential candidate, and of course in this situation it's also a question of what information is he giving. Sometimes the information and the cover-up is actually maybe worse than the original situation, sexual harassment is very serious.
Right, and certainly the way he's been handling it this week is raising new questions about him for many people. But for you as a former mediator and employment discrimination lawyer, what Kevin raises was very interesting and something that hasn't been discussed very much. He doesn't want the rules of his business, of this mediation business, where people agree to mutual confidentiality, kind of just thrown out because people are curious. So I guess the public policy question becomes, do you think this situation uniquely demands a more public accounting because Cain is running for president, so therefore the woman should speak because the public has a right to know what the accusations are? Or is that a slippery slope? Because today it's an imperative because of a presidential run. Then we'll say tomorrow it's because somebody's applying to be a CEO and that matters, and on down the road.
Well, first of all, I do agree with Kevin that if somebody enters the mediation process, confidentiality is very important. It does, as you say, raise public policy concerns. What we don't want to do, in some ways, a lot of these cases go to arbitration, which is really private. It's really important to, in terms of the goal of these civil rights statutes, these employment discrimination statutes, to eradicate unlawful discrimination, is to have some public knowledge of it. And so much of this has become private, and that is a problem. Mm. On the other hand, you do want to be able to foster a dialogue and mediation to try to resolve these complaints, and it does have to have some privacy. With respect to the question you asked, I would not put the burden on this woman to come forward at this point if she chooses not to do so. However, in some ways she has. She released through her attorney some information. They were saying that that Mr. Kane, in essence, violated part of the confidentiality provision by even talking about it, and so they wanted to put out a counter story or scenario. And so at this point, she has almost said, yes, I'm willing to engage in this discussion.
But only to a point, because she said she doesn't want to release minute details. Jane on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane.
Hey, Brian.
So were you in a situation like this?
Yeah, uh-huh. And it wasn't actually, it was, so now I'm getting tongue-tied because it's emotional, even though it happened a while ago. So the whole issue of confidentiality was really important to me, and I actually came so close to signing the confidentiality agreement that I had the other attorney fax me an image of the check that had already been drawn to me, and then I went ahead and did not sign the confidentiality agreement, and I filed complaints and all this stuff. And it was a really interesting, when I look back at my life, it was interesting. I passed up a chunk of money. And the one thing I haven't heard, I missed some of your conversation because I was talking to the screener, but mm-hmm. I haven't heard, like, what's good for the woman? Is it, like, the mediator who said it's good for her because she wants privacy? That's what made me pick up the phone to call, even though I didn't really want to.
So why didn't you?
Because part of what happens when you're sexually harassed is that you're intimidated into shutting the hell up. You know, that's part of what happens. So when you go through the process of negotiating and the other person is trying to get you to shut up and not talk about it, and, like, if you can't even tell the people who are close to your life at risk of losing money and getting involved in again, that is just too close to the initial harassment that happened in the first place. And
yeah.
So it's real, and on top of which, I also had a sense of responsibility to the next woman, because when people harass, they're likely to do it again. And what if there's another complainant down the road, and I could talk to her and buttress her and support her, but I can't talk. So those are really important issues. I'm really glad that, in retrospect, I actually don't like to talk about it anymore, and I don't talk about it anymore, but I'm really glad that I can tell you, if I wanted to, I could talk about it.
Yes.
Because to have my tongue under lock and key is kind of what was happening when it was happening, too, in many diverse ways. And so it's, you know,
I understand.
I'm proud that I walked away from the money.
Did you go to court?
No.
You just walked away from the money so that you continue to maintain your freedom of speech.
Exactly. Even
wow.
though I don't even use it anymore. I don't like to. I didn't want to call you, but
sure.
I felt like you need to have a woman talking to you today.
Jane, thank you so
right.
much.
Hooray for Jane. I think that that's a point well taken, and I think that's what people have to understand is that there are lots of complaints that are officially made to the EEOC, many more complaints that are buried internally, and then thousands and thousands of women who are discouraged for all kinds of reasons from coming forward. And so when somebody like Jane comes forward and says there is a reason to kind of pursue justice in a way, although she did not pursue money damages, it's important for others, because what we see, those who come forward are really the tip of the iceberg. The problem remains fairly large in the country, that the recent surveys show that many, many women are being sexually harassed. Men are being sexually harassed, too, at a much lower rate, but, you know, and we have some same-sex harassment going on in the workplace.
Jane, again, thank you for the courage to call in and speak. We thank our guest, Rick Rosane, CUNY Law School professor, who teaches workplace discrimination, and there's a little context that I haven't been hearing elsewhere on the sexual harassment confidentiality agreement that is now one of the issues in this Herman Cain story. Professor Rosane, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. All right, folks, power's still out. Time to call in, 212-433-WNYC. We are going to have a call-in now for the next few minutes for anyone who is still without power 5 days after the Saturday snowstorm, 212-433-9692. Has your power been out since Saturday? Call with your story. How are you coping? How is your community working through this? Who are you mad at? 212-433-WNYC. And hello, Teaneck. Anyone home from school today? Happen to be listening? Teaneck schools still closed because of hazardous road conditions from the storm. Has there ever been an October snow day in New Jersey before? I'll bet not. Call us from Teaneck and tell everyone else about the road conditions in your neighborhood and what it's like to be home from school for so long because of weather without any real weather still happening outside. 212-433-9692. And who are you mad at? Anyone? This seems to have a slightly different vibe for me from Hurricane Irene. A little edgier reaction to this on the part of a lot of people. So call with your story. How are you coping? How is your community working through this? And who, if anyone, are you mad at? Our lines are full already. 212-433-WNYC or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and we'll take your calls in a minute.